from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American millennials aged 18 to 33 are moving up, moving in, and creating, in many ways, a different America. Demographically, they don't look like boomers. Culturally, they don't think quite like Americans who came before. They will be the next America. This hour On Point, the next America and the millennials at the heart of it. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What changes do you see coming as America's millennials move up, take over? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll hear it straight from millennials in a moment. But joining me first today from Washington is Paul Taylor, Executive Vice President of the Pew Research Center. They've just come out with a big new survey on millennial outlooks and attitudes. And Paul is out with a new book titled The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. Paul Taylor, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So I'm reading right from the top here. You say you're 65 this year, at least when, as the book comes out. You say the America of my childhood, that's yours, with its expanding middle class, secure jobs, intact nuclear families, devout believers, distinct gender roles, polite politics, consensus-building media, is nothing like the country your one-year-old granddaughter will inherit. Where are the big changes coming, Paul, and why?
Well, you touched on them. They're political, they're cultural, they're technological, they're institutional, and the pace of change is really breathtaking. If you want to start with demographics, there are two extraordinary changes that are happening all around us. Either one would be the demographic story of the century. The fact that they're both happening simultaneously is going to put a lot of stress on everything we care about, from our politics to our families. So the two changes are we're becoming a rainbow nation. In 1960, our population was 85% white. By 2060, our population will be 43% white. This is a change driven mostly by the big wave of Hispanic and Asian immigration that we're in the midst of now. It's them. It's their U.S.-born children that are changing our complexion. The second change is me and people like me. I actually turned 65 last week.
Okay. Congratulations. Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you very much. 10,000 other baby boomers turned 65 the day that I did. Another 10,000 the day after and the day after and the day after. This goes on until the year 2030. We were the giant pig in a python generation when we were young. They had to build more schools for us and all the rest. Now here we are crossing the threshold into old age, collecting our Social Security and Medicare. All to the good. These are programs that are enormously successful and popular, but the math is not going to work. And we know demographically when those programs run out of money, and it's within the next decade or two. We simply don't have enough young people to pay for the retirement benefits of older people. This will be a big challenge to fix the math of those programs, and we're going to have to do it at a time when our generations don't look, think, and vote alike.
Do you see a conscious, sort of articulated confrontation coming? Somehow millennials lined up on one side of a battlefield over these programs for the older citizens of the country and boomers on the other, and a fight over whether or not they're going to sustain them or not.
I think there is a potential for that if you just look at the math that I've described. But here's the, if you will, the grace note in the book, and it's a grace note built not on my own sort of optimistic glass half full view of the world, and I confess to having such a view. It's based on our data and our public opinion surveys, is a generation war needs combatants. We don't see any evidence from our surveys that young and old are spoiling for a fight over this. They like each other too much. And I frankly contrast that with my own coming of age, my generation's coming of age in the 1960s.
Don't trust anybody over 30.
Yeah, there was a whiff of generation war back then in the counterculture movements and civil rights and women's rights and anti-war and all the rest. And yeah, don't trust anybody over 30 was one of the rallying cries. You ask kids today, I say kids, I mean young adults, who has better moral values, the young or the old? And about three quarters of young adults say the old, as do older adults. This is a consensual generation. This is a generation that likes its parents and grandparents. Frankly, this is a generation that also doesn't want to bite the hand that feeds them at a much greater rate than in previous generations. A lot of 20-somethings and even 30-somethings are still living with mom and dad because they have been dealt a very tough hand economically. They can't find jobs. And mom and dad, you know, the refrigerator is stocked and you don't have to put coins into the washing machine. So it's a pretty good place to hang out, particularly if you can kind of become roommates rather than kids. And a lot of families are going through this. And that's a building block for a more consensual solution to the demographic and economic challenges of rebalancing the safety net.
You describe the demographic changes coming as the millennials become the mainstream of society by 2060. White America down from 85% in 1960 to 43%. At that point, projections are 43% white this country will be, 13% black, 31% Hispanic, 8% Asian, 6% everything else. There's the demographic, racial, ethnic breakdown. What about the cultural changes, the ways of of thinking, the outlook on life? What about the change there?
Well, but let's make a segue. Let's stay with those racial categories because the ones you describe are the ones we're familiar with. But there is this growing other population, and that's part of the cultural change. If you look at all new and in some ways our old labels aren't keeping pace with our new weddings. Of all new marriages in the last few years, about 1 in 6 are across racial or ethnic lines. So more than half of Hispanic and Asians are marrying out, as are about 1 in 6 blacks and 1 in 10 whites.
So all these lines may be fuzzy by 2060,
too.
More and more
fuzzy. And these are lines that were pretty thick, you know, in terms of how we define ourselves.
Yeah.
And you go back just a generation or two, it's a gasp-inducing taboo to marry across racial lines. Until the late 60s, it was still illegal in many states. Mm-hmm. So this is part of the cultural change. And it's a change. It's a much more tolerant society. Listen, anytime you have big immigration waves, anytime you change the racial complexion of any society, you're going to have blowback, you're going to have tension and all the rest. And I don't mean to suggest we don't have that. You know, think about the ads that ran on the Super Bowl and the Olympics just last month. This is Coke, this is Cheerios, this is Chevy. These are the most iconic American advertisers. They're spending $4 million for 30 seconds. And they have the typical TV family. We've been looking at TV family ads all our lives. They now have TV families. Same-sex couples raising children, interracial couples raising children, America the Beautiful sung in 6 different languages. They predictably got some blowback, in the Twittersphere about that. But by and large, but they look at the data, and they know how we're changing.
So they're reading the market. They have to sell to this market. I've got a little bit of that right here. Paul, here's an Amazon Kindle ad from last year. Man and woman talking on the beach about which devices are better. Then they both realize they both have, each has a husband.
I just bought a Kindle Paperwhite. We should celebrate.
My husband's bringing me a drink right now.
So is mine.
Gay marriage right there in an Amazon Kindle ad. I mean, they're reading the market. They see what it is. Well, you know, Pew Center just came out last month with this new survey on attitudes. And there you've got all kinds of changes in the way, starting with institutions, how millennials look at institutions.
Right. So the millennials are, we describe them as somewhat unmoored from institutions. So they are the least likely of any generation to say they identify with a political party. They're the least likely to say they identify with an organized religion. The other core institution of the society that they're not a part of, at least not yet, is marriage. Of 20-somethings today, only about 1/4 are married. If you go to their parents' and grandparents' generation, half or 2/3 were married at this stage of life. There are economic reasons, I think, for the inability at this stage yet to think you're ready to be married. But there's also a cultural shift in just how you relate to the world. And they look at these traditional institutions, and they also then look at that thing they have in their hand, which gives them the ability through social media to create their own universes. And that's what they're doing. They are digital natives. It's second nature to them to build up enormous social media networks and frankly, to place themselves at the center of it. We had some fun in this report we put out last week with the selfie. We did the survey actually just before the Oscars when the selfie selfie sort of had a big moment with Ellen DeGeneres. Mm-hmm. But the selfie had a big enough moment throughout last year that it was Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year in 2013.
Yeah. Of course, it was harder for grandparents to do it. Colin Powell may have done it, but it was tougher then. You described this generation, millennials, as loaded with debt. We understand that. All plugged in social network-wise, but distrustful of people.
Yeah.
And then somehow, out of all that, optimistic about the future, even with the debt, even with the distrust.
Yeah.
How do the pieces fit together?
It's really fascinating, and I'm not sure I can fit all the pieces of the puzzle together, but each data point is really fascinating. Let's start with the low levels of social trust. This is a question that we and other survey research organizations have been asking for decades. It's a very simple question. Generally speaking, would you say most people can be trusted or you can't be too careful? Only 19% of millennials say most people can be trusted. That's only about half as much as older folks say. These numbers, trust numbers throughout all generations have been coming down in the last few decades, but the millennials are starting out as the least trusting. What we can see in our data is they are also the most non-white generation. More than 40% of millennials are non-white, and we can see a correlation between minority groups and low levels of trust. We can also see a correlation between low income and low levels of trust. And the sociological explanation, as far as it goes, is people who feel vulnerable in a society for whatever reason are inclined not to be trustful of others because they're not well fortified to deal with the consequences of misplaced trust. So that may be one of the things going on there.
Por tus olas de granos
d'ambar. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the next America, boomers and more, handing off to millennials and what that's going to look like. Behind me right here, the kind of controversial Super Bowl ad from Coca-Cola this year where America the Beautiful is sung in multiple languages. The ad drew some controversy for its emphasis on a multicultural, more diverse America. My guest Paul Taylor says that is exactly where we're headed, and marketers like Coke know it. He's author of the new book, The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Stephen Colbert gave the commencement address at the University of Virginia last year, had a little fun with this, included a very real illustration of the millennial-boomer divide with the Comedy Central satirist and Colbert Report host told the graduating class that they, the millennials, were too self-interested.
So self-obsessed, tweeting your Vines, hashtagging your Spotifys, and Snapchatting your YOLOs. Your generation needs everything to be about you. And that's very upsetting to us baby boomers because self-absorption is kind of our thing.
Hey, that's our thing, says Stephen Colbert right there. Paul Taylor joins us from Washington, where he's executive vice president of the Pew Research Center. I want to bring a couple more voices in right now, if I may, Paul, to join us. Also from Washington, Kat Chow is here, race, culture, and ethnicity reporter for NPR's Code Switch project, online, on-air coverage focusing on America's changing demographic profile. She's 23. Kat, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's great to have you. And from Milwaukee, Evan Ritleski joins us. He's a music editor at Milwaukee's alt-weekly Shepherd Express. He's 32 years old. And Evan, I guess I should say welcome back to you. You last joined us 10 years ago when we were looking at jobs for college graduates. You were a senior then at the University of Wisconsin, editor-in-chief of the Daily Cardinal there in Madison. Hey, now you're 10 years on down the road, still that millennial, Evan. Thank you very much for being with us again today.
Yes, so good to be back.
It's terrific to have you with us. You all must have heard about some of this. I know you've read the survey results that Paul and Pew Center have come out with in the last week, and there's just been a lot of talk about millennials in recent years as you move up and out into the world. And I'm curious just how, broadly speaking, how it strikes you to be poked and prodded and dissected and anticipated in this way. Kat, let me come first to you.
You know, that's actually a really good question and something that we've been thinking about, or I've been thinking about a lot. The term millennial, there's just something about it that gives me this knee-jerk reaction where I don't want to be classified as one. And I don't know if, and I'm very familiar with the Pew report that came out, I don't know if it's because I have a dislike of institutions, but I think what my feelings about millennial and that term kind of stems from is how complex that group is. You know, we have a group of folks who are age 18 to 33, and that's such a big amount of people that we're talking about. And so you find all of these nuances and differences. My experience is probably far different than somebody who is not born of immigrant parents. My parents came to the States from China. Mm-hmm. And so in general, being lumped into millennials isn't something that I'm thrilled about. But then I also see these qualities where I do fall in line with the research that's been released.
I mean, surveys are surveys, and they can be right, or I suppose they can be wrong, but then demographics also have their implications. Evan, just broadly speaking, the way your generation's being described and anticipated as it moves center stage.
Yeah, it seems pretty spot on, actually. I was sort of expecting not to see much of myself in this report, and then you read the report, and yep, that's pretty much me and everybody I know. And, yeah, like Kat, I'm not sure I want to be lumped into this big generalized category, sort of the way the boomers were. But that being said, I do see a lot of myself in there.
Talk to us about what resonates and what might not. Let's go to institutions. You know, described here in the Pew report, the recent one is relatively unattached to organized politics and religion.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I think we're flexible. I think even though I think we've got liberal social values, as that study pointed out, or at least people I frequent with living in a city, I think we're flexible. And it's the same with religion. I know a lot of religious people, but it doesn't seem to define them the same way it defined religious boomers.
Paul Taylor, you're listening here. You've been involved in a lot of this research and survey work. How do you interpret the pull away from institutional association, and what replaces it?
Well, I think social media, to some degree, replaces it. It is certainly the platform that young adults use to organize their social lives, their professional lives. It takes up a lot of their time. The typical millennial has 250 Facebook friends. Let me make one other comment, though, about the conceit, and it is a conceit, that there is such a thing as a generation, and you can make generalizations about the personalities.
Lumping that Kat talks about.
Yeah. I absolutely get that. And listen, I'm a boomer, and everybody thinks the boomers were, well, you know, in the lore, the boomers were all the same. Of course, there are enormous differences within any generation, and here's a little trick I play on people. The first election that boomers were old enough to vote was 1972. That's when they lowered the voting age to 18. You remember the boomers? They were anti-war, they were anti-draft, and everything else. So who did the boomers vote for in 1972? Richard Nixon or the anti-war candidate George McGovern? The majority of boomers voted for, and these are now 18 to 24 year olds, they voted for Richard Nixon.
So yeah, and they may have dreamed of living in hippie communes, or maybe they did, but then came the era of Reagan in their
That's
heyday.
Right. So there are always huge differences within any generation, but the notion is that a given age cohort comes of age at roughly the same time, experiences the same historical patterns and trends, and develops a generational persona. For my money, it is the fact that this generation of young adults are digital natives. This amazing revolution in how we communicate and how we understand the world is something somebody my age has to adapt to and struggles to adapt to in many ways. In somebody their age, it's the only world they've ever known, and they're very, very nimble with it.
Kat Chow, what are your thoughts on how the society operates when social media are the glue or the sort of network infrastructure versus political parties, churches, synagogues, temples, you know, religious institutions, unions, when it's less of that kind of institution and more Facebook, Twitter, or whatever comes beyond, how does that work out?
Yeah, exactly. So for my job, I mean, I run a lot of social media for my team, Code Switch, and we're a team that reports on race and culture. And what we do is live mostly on Twitter and Facebook. I mean, yes, we are on air and we are in the form of a blog, but the way we connect and have conversations with people is through Twitter chats or engaging with people. And when you look at the breakdown of our Twitter followers, and I can't give you exact numbers, but it seems that it skews very generally young, people who are in their 20s or 30s. And we have a diverse audience. And by diverse, I mean we have folks who identify as people of color. And whether that's our content or the fact that, you know, research has said that African Americans and Latinos tend to use Twitter a lot, or a majority of them, that makes sense to me, is that the way people are connecting is on social media and in the digital space. And that's how people find their communities, and that's where they orient themselves as opposed to institutions.
Evan, how do you think, I mean, you're 10 years down the road from when we last talked to you, about 10 years down the road from KET, how do you think that translates or doesn't into political power, social change, cohesiveness, or, you know, sort of molecular breakup in a culture? How's it work, Evan?
Yeah, I think by and large it makes us more tolerant. I think by being so connected and being on Twitter, where we're exposed to people of all sorts of different backgrounds and viewpoints, we're just generally more open-minded. And I think it's a good thing for the most part. I mean, I know personally I'm on there and my viewpoints are constantly being challenged by other people, or I'm constantly being introduced to different lifestyles or different ways of looking at the world. And I think as a result, we're just more open to everything. We're not as grounded in tradition, maybe, as the boomers were.
Paul, how do you interpret the significance of that for American politics going forward? If it's the next America, you've got that flexibility and new means of interacting. What does that mean for parties, for policy, for the direction of the country, Paul?
Well, I would pick up on the tolerance comment, and I think Evan has it exactly right. This is striking about these young adults. They are open to a lot of change. So for example, an important issue over the last decade or so, gay marriage. You only have to go back about 10 years where that was such a political winner for the Republican Party, opposition to gay marriage, that in the 2004 presidential campaign, they made sure that there were gay marriage ballot initiatives in about 10 or 11 of the key presidential battleground states, knowing that the fact that the initiative was on the ballot, it would surely be voted down, and they would draw a big, big outpouring of conservatives who wanted to vote it down and then presumably. Yeah. So that was only 10 years ago. And we went through a 10-year period where there were 32 gay marriage ballot initiatives, and every single one of them lost. Then in 2012, there were four, and they all won. And we have tracked this with our public opinion surveys. It's rare we've seen any issue that has public opinion has moved so swiftly in one direction. It's moved among all adults. It's certainly with millennials in the lead. So here's a case where and listen, let's understand that there's still a substantial minority now of Americans who oppose gay marriage. They oppose it because they were taught this goes deep to the core of their religious beliefs and their moral beliefs. They're not bad people. This is how they were grown. This is how they have been taught. And the fact that we've had this much change in this short a time is surely a part of a broader change. So the younger adults are coming in. They have these more tolerant attitudes. They have them towards immigration. They have them towards marriage. Marijuana legalization is another one of them. Older adults kind of looking at all this, a little bit nervous about it, wary about it. But the younger adults are where the numbers are. Let me conclude this little segment on this point. We know how important the younger adults were to electing Barack Obama twice. You only have to go back 10 or 15 years, and old and young in this country didn't vote any different in presidential elections. In the last two or three elections, there's been an enormous age gap in how young and old vote.
More older voters, you're saying.
That's right. Older voters, more conservative. Younger voters, more liberal across a whole range of political and social dimensions and in their voting patterns. They don't like to say they're Democrats because they don't affiliate with organized politics, but boy, they vote Democratic. So in 2012, millennials accounted for about 18% of everybody who voted on Election Day, even though by then they were already 26% of the age-eligible electorate. They don't vote in as high numbers as older adults. Turnout tends to increase as people get older. If you just project forward to 2020, millennials, by then all of them will be in the electorate. There are still some presumably mid-teen millennials who haven't aged in. By 2020, millennials will be 38% of the age-eligible electorate. So this is where our future is. This is where our politics is going. And woe be to the politician or the political party that doesn't understand, or the advertiser, or Coke.
They're already there, I think.
That doesn't understand them. Yeah. This is the next America.
Paul, Kat, Evan, stand by. Let's bring our listeners in. Jimmy in Lexington, Kentucky. Jimmy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi. What do you see coming?
I could probably talk to you about a number of points, and some of your commenters have already touched on them. I think religiously, we're less religious. I think you're exposed to a broad array of theologies out there and kind of, less set in your ways. And I think for myself, I'm not particularly religious, but I still have a very good moral compass.
Okay.
I don't see it as a necessity. And, one of your commenters had said that, just more tolerance. So I think from a religious standpoint, tolerance is a big point.
What about politics, Jimmy?
Politics, I think, I see it headed towards libertarianism, to be honest with you. My age group, people I talk to, I'm 27 years old, they tend to... We all agree on the social issues. Like, I would probably identify myself as a Republican, but it's only because I believe I have a background in accounting, economics, finance, and that sort of thing. So that's kind of the realm I come from. But, when it comes to gay marriage, when it comes to marijuana, prostitution, I say legalize every bit of it, have good controls in place where it's not done in the public and that sort of thing. But, and in that light, I see the future of politics has to be libertarianism. If my generation can get all these social issues out of the way and focus on the economic ones. And frankly, I think in electing Barack Obama, a lot of my generation was idealistic and optimistic and, kind of went with his, went with what he was pitching.
Hope.
At the end of the day, now what we see is some stark economic times. And I think people are going to start to, place more emphasis on the economics, and the social issues will be more resolved than a thing of the past.
How old are you, Jimmy, if I may ask? How old are you?
I'm 27 years old.
27 and thinking pretty well about it. Jimmy, our time is short before the break. I really appreciate your call. Evan, on this political front, what about it? Do you think your generation, millennials, will perpetuate the right-left divide, or are we headed into some new kind of configuration?
I think there is a strong argument to be made for libertarianism, just because if you look at the data, we are approaching something resembling a consensus on social issues. We're generally socially liberal, and that is a thing that unites us. So this is an opportunity for libertarians, but it's by no means a sure thing. I mean, as the other data shows, we could go either way. We're flexible.
I mean, after that cultural issue, Kat Chow, you've either going to have a social safety net of strength or not. Even beyond the cultural issues, there's still potential here for left-right.
Yeah, I mean, to echo kind of what Evan was saying, I think millennials are flexible. It can go either way. I mean, there's no sure answer to see how this all develops.
But, I mean, here you're going to be looking at, do we keep Social Security going? There are always questions about welfare, housing, unemployment. Surely your generation will have to wrestle with those as well, Kat.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what the Pew Report talks about, is that how millennials don't seem too concerned about those issues, or that we're generally optimistic, and yet these issues are really going to come to a head.
Paul, have a prediction in here about who ends up or what politics end up coming out of this new complexion?
I don't. I do think that the millennials, it's interesting, inside the millennials, there's no question that the social liberalism cuts across all components, if you will, of the millennial generation. On attitudes towards government, is government a good thing? Is an activist government something we want, which is the reverse of what libertarians believe? A lot of millennials, more millennials than any other age group, say yes. And if you look inside that, it's mostly the minorities within millennials who say yes. And this tracks with what we know about minorities through our history, that minorities tend to look for government for protections, a felt need for protections for civil rights.
Hold it there if you would. We've got a lot to unpack in a break right in front of us. We're talking about the next America, millennials. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'm
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the next America, baby boomers and more, handing off to the millennials and what that's going to look like. Paul Taylor is with us from the Pew Research Center. He's author of The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And a couple of millennials, wonderful, with us right here. Kat Chow, she works for NPR's Code Switch, joins us from Washington, 23 years old. And Evan Rytleski, who joined us a decade ago on this show, back with us today. He was then editor-in-chief of the Daily Cardinal at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He's now at Milwaukee's alt-weekly Shepherd Express, music editor there, 32 years old. Stephen Colbert, thinking about millennials when he talked again here to UVA commencement last spring. Spring, saying good luck to them, given the world they will inherit. Boomers have already had at it, said Colbert.
We took all the money. We soaked up all the government services, and we've deep-fried nearly everything in the ocean. It may seem that all that's left for you is unpaid internships, Monday to Tuesday mail delivery, and thanks to global warming, soon semester at sea will mean sailing the coast of Ohio.
Oh, boy. We hope for better. Gavin in Kings Mountain, North Carolina is calling. Gavin, thanks. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hey.
And I actually did have a few points to make on this topic. As far as politics and my generation, and I'm actually currently at the age of 21.
Okay.
I think looking at it, basically, it comes down for us and my generation. And it really just comes down to adapting to the environment, I think, because we have these new economic incentives for us to where more pressure is put on us to go to college. And I can say that myself because I'm currently a student at UNC Charlotte. And I think having that makes us not only wait for marriage later on,
mm-hmm.
but it also kind of, it gives us more of a sense to look at empirical evidence for things.
So do you mean adapting to the economic environment, Gavin? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and because of the political issues, and not only political, I mean, they're major global issues that are still persistent in the older generations with the baby boomers and such.
Yep.
And I think my generation kind of sees it that we mistrust political institutions because we look at empirical evidence and we question things outside of the box a little bit more, maybe.
Yep.
But at the same time, we're optimistic about the future because our generation sees an opportunity for us to change these different political issues and actually find solutions for them through research and empirical evidence.
You know, that begins to turn the key in the lock in my mind. I really appreciate that, Gavin. Kat Chow, that's interesting because, you know, The implication in Paul's work is a little bit like they got all these problems and all this debt. They don't trust each other yet. They're optimistic. How could that be? Gavin says, well, we're going to think it through ourselves and not be prisoner of old perspectives. What do you say, Kat?
Yeah, you know, that's actually really interesting. So I think it's, what, 49% of millennials say that the U.S.'s best years are ahead. And when you look at how Blacks and Latinos also track, I mean, Gallup had a poll just this year that said Blacks and Latinos are twice as likely as whites to be optimistic. And even though Blacks and Latinos have historically low unemployment rates compared to whites, I mean, I think Black unemployment has consistently been double that of whites. You see these data points and you still see a sense of optimism. And so I think that really speaks to the idea that, I mean, even though there's all of this history, millennials tend to think that there is a brighter future ahead.
Evan, how do you read the optimism in spite of everything that Colbert and, you know, the everyday headlines describe?
I read it as confidence in ourselves. I think that a lot of us believe we'll be able to achieve something even though we were dealt a hard hand. I know that, you know, for a lot of people my age who graduated college in the mid-2000s, we inherited a terrible economy.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of our life decisions reflect that. I think a lot of the reason a lot of us have delayed marriage, postponed starting families, is so we can sort of get our feet in the ground, so we can find jobs, so we can secure health insurance, and then so we can move ahead. So I don't think that we're pessimistic in any way, because I think we think we will get these things. We will get families, we will get marriages, we will get good jobs, we will get eventually the incomes that we want. But we understand it's going to take a while. This was a weird situation with the economy. We just sort of needed to rebuild a little bit.
Paul, you're our 65-year-old here at this point. Now, you're a glass-half-full kind of guy, but when you look at the realities this generation is facing, and then look at that optimism, what are you thinking? Are you thinking, well, it's justified, or are you thinking, oh, these young folks are delusional? Or what's your thought, Paul? Hello, Paul Taylor. Well, I lost Paul for the moment. Let's hear from our listeners. Molly in Holliston, Massachusetts. Molly, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Again, I hate using the word to describe myself, but I am a millennial. I'm 23. And I just wanted to talk about the section of us that seem to not be represented often in these kinds of surveys. You know, the people who don't have smartphones, the ones who aren't taking selfies, don't tweet, aren't that plugged in, and they're more, this phrase is overused, but they're more in the DIY group, and it has a lot to do with what we were just talking about. And I think a lot of us were pushed into that from the, you know, crash in 2008. We learned we couldn't rely on others, and so we became a lot more self-sufficient and are just trying to make it happen for ourselves.
Molly, when you DIY, do it yourself, are you sort of talking, back to the lander kind of stuff? Grow your own organic veggies and all? Is that where you're looking?
Yeah, it's actually, I would say it's almost kind of like a second back to the land, but it's not just nature-oriented, and it's not just homesteading-oriented. It's sort of everything. It's learning how to fix your own bike, what I'm doing right now. It's learning how to strike out on your own, make your own little thing, even if you can't afford to have, you know, apartment rents are crazy wherever you are right now. It's just learning to do your own plumbing, electricity, you know, all that.
So the makers and all that, but don't you take the tech with you, Molly? Doesn't your generation, even when it's, you know, becoming a maker, doesn't the cell phone still ring?
I guess it depends on what level. Like I said, I don't have a smartphone and I don't want one, but I still do have one and I still have a laptop, and that is important for connecting, and that's how I get a lot of my news. So, I mean, there's that, but it's not a huge part. Not everyone is so obsessed with their technology that consumes most of their life, and I feel like that's the picture that's painted.
Yeah, that's interesting. Diversity, even on that spectrum. Kat, what do you think? Is that tech savviness going to be fundamental to your generation's sort of grappling with the world, or is it a significant population, maybe like Molly, that's saying, oh, I don't want to build my life around tech, thank you?
I mean, yeah, I think that there still is that significant population. I mean, the study even said that, 55% of millennials have taken selfies, but you still have that other percentage that has just staunchly refused not to. But I mean, when you have, and this was, I mean, this piece was what it was, but the New York Times a month ago had a piece on how selfies, for example, might be better when they're uglier. Things like that, where technology might not always be the best indicator of progress.
Let's go to Mike in Framingham, Massachusetts. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, I love the topic. I'm a boomer. I was born in 58, and then I work with a lot of the millennials. I find that this generation, the millennial generation, or I call them the sheep generation.
What are you saying? Sheep? Sheep? What? Sheep like the animal?
Sheep. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
They're herded by talking points. They're herded by the latest electronic gimmick. They don't look in depth at the issues that I think. I just don't think they're just not informed. They're more of the talking point generation. They're more interested in the most latest device that's come out, our entertainment. I mean, you give them the choice of watching Real World, some reality show, or give them the choice to, say, listen to NPR. To use that as an example. And they'll pick that reality show. When I was a young man, a politician, you know, shook your hand and came out and went more door-to-door. Now it's more done by basically groups, special interest groups, who can control the airwaves. And this generation, I believe, is moving so fast that they can only get that small, the talking point, that small.
Hey, Mike, stick with it. I think we got the flavor of it. Stick with us here. We got a lot of young listeners right here as well, but let's put it to Evan and Kat. I mean, Evan, the sheep generation, herded by talking points. You've been around, you've been an editor yourself, you've had to summarize things. What do you think, Evan?
Yeah, maybe it's my millennial optimism, but I don't see it that way. I think if anything, technology has made us better at vetting information. We know that we've got options. We're better consumers. We know how to research goods before we buy them. I like to think that that extends to the way we vote. I like to think that we can cut through misinformation and find out what's what. When you look at it, we're the ones who know not to click on spam emails. It's the boomers who are the ones getting tricked into all those phishing scams. I think that we're smart consumers of the Internet. I think that that technology has made us better informed in most areas of our lives.
Kat, what do you say about that ding on millennials by a boomer who says, Mike says he works with a lot of millennials?
You know, I would say that actually I think that technology has helped us, and maybe this is where the distrust comes into play. It's helped us be a little bit more skeptical of what's in front of us. I mean, as Evan said, it lets us know to not click on the spam emails that are phishing for passwords or specific information. But I mean, I think in that sense, we're not just the sheep who have talking points in front of us.
I wonder exactly how Mike gets that impression. If you had to put yourself in his boomer head and imagine where he gets it from, what do you think, Kat?
I mean, I could see it coming from, you know, the inundation of selfies and technology that we see in media. So, I mean, it was mentioned before, the Ellen DeGeneres selfie,
yeah.
Where we see these trends crop up in pop culture, and you see the millennial or folks who are the age of millennials emulating that behavior. But I don't necessarily think that those things always have to be hand in hand.
Mike, we're thinking about the way it strikes you and your experience right there. Caleb in Charlotte, North Carolina. Caleb, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say, as a millennial myself, I'm 25.
Okay.
I'm the kind of person that I had a cell phone and I had Facebook and I used to do all that. However, we're also the first generation that has been mass advertised to. We're very discerning about what we believe, and that's where you see some of the flexibility of our loyalties come in, where we may believe one thing on one issue, but that doesn't mean that just because, say, we're fiscally conservative, we're Republican. We don't believe in that title because we've been advertised for so long that we can see everything that the Republicans are putting out. And we maybe don't agree with that, or we don't agree with the Democrats, but it's just so polarizing. And for us, we're the first generation with internet access that we can actually go out and verify what's being advertised to us. So then we go out and make our own opinions.
Choose to do it, and you can be very savvy. Caleb, I appreciate that call. Let me get one more right here from Boonville, New York. Nick is calling. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm 70 years old, and I look at this, and I agree with everything that's sort of been said by millennials and older people. However, we always talk about economics instead of the environment. Everything surrounds the earth is the environment. Economics is second to everything. We can't have these arguments without saving the planet. And millennials know this. The only problem is they have to be able to find a way with older people like myself to move on and break this corruption of the whole system, which is polluting the planet. Not climate change, pollution.
Hey, Nick, I appreciate your call. I want to put that to both of you, Kat and Evan, because plenty of people look at the environment, look at the projections for this century, say we are in dire trouble, and that's going to be your lifetime. And I wonder if you end up feeling despairing or we're going to get our hands on the wheel and do something about it. Evan, how do you look at that big one that Nick raises?
You know, I like to think we're concerned with the greater good, and I like to think that it's an issue we'll address. But I think the caller has a point. It's environmentalism has sort of fallen off of our radar a little bit. On one end, we grew up with it. We know to recycle in a way the boomers didn't. We're conscious of what we buy. We turn off lights. So on a very practical level, it's part of the way we live, and I think it always will be. But in terms of an organized political movement, we're not as concerned about it as we are other social issues and economic issues.
Kat, how about you? Do you despair when you think about the environment, or do you think we'll fix it, despite the fact the clock's ticking already?
I think the clock is ticking, and what I see in my everyday life are things like cities passing bans on plastic bags. And you have these little steps toward a gigantic issue that we're facing. And I'm not sure that policy will exactly get there because we have so many social issues in front of us. But in the everyday life, I see more smaller steps being made that I think millennials would get on board with.
Paul, if a boomer were to come back, I don't know, 50 years from now, cocoon style, and sit down into the world that Kat and Evan's generation creates, what will they recognize, do you think, Paul? And what may really surprise them?
Well, I think the technology 50 years from now, well, who knows what the technology will be like. I think that is already stunning to boomers and will continue to be. Just a quick comment on environmentalists. We asked this in a poll a couple of weeks ago of adults of all generations. Do you consider yourself this, that, or the other? And we gave a number of labels. One of them was environmentalist. Millennials were less likely than the older generations to say they consider themselves an environmentalist. Only about a third do, whereas more than 4 in 10 of the older generations do. So I think Evan has it right. It's hardwired into how they live their lives to a degree that's different from the past. But the identification with the movement and perhaps the political activism that would come with that hasn't been forthcoming yet.
Evan, there's this chance of a generational showdown here that Paul writes about as well. Do you feel that coming? Do you fear that sooner or later the weight of the boomers is going to feel crushing to millennials and there'll be pushback from you and Kat and millions of others?
No, not at all. I don't think it'll ever come to that. You know, the boomers are our parents, our grandparents. And I think when you look at the data and just talk to millennials, we're not at all resentful. I think if you look at what happened with the economic crisis, you could think that millennials might be like, oh, man, we really inherited a bad country because of what the previous generation did. But I don't think anybody really thinks like that at all. I think we see sort of a responsibility to fix things where we can and also to take care of the boomers.
A lot of boomers are going to breathe a sigh of relief right there. But looking over that whole horizon, I've got to say, I take a lot of heart from the perspectives that I'm hearing here today, from what I read in your work, Paul. It's going to be different, yes. But it's in America I'm going to vote with confidence for. Evan Rytleski, 10 years ago you were great. You're great again today. Thank you for joining us, Evan.
Thanks so much.
Kat Chow at NPR's Code Switch. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you.
And Paul Taylor, author of The Next America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.